Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents In Praise of Listening, a Gathering of Stories by Christian McEwan. Narrated by Christian McEwan. In memory of Marielle Kinsey and Parker Huber, two peerless listeners. Introduction. The ear draws forth the story. Italo Calvino. In Praise of Listening. Will come a time, say the Anishinaabe, when the world's people will arrive at a fork in the road. The air will be too thick to breathe, and it will no longer be possible to dip a cup into a stream and bring out fresh water to drink. At that time, they say, we'll have to walk back along the paths of our ancestors, retrieving all the many treasures they've left behind. Each of us will find something that we need. Some tale, some parable, some crucial story. We'll pick it up and put it in our knapsack, whatever we can carry, large or small, and together we will walk on down the road. For me, one of those crucial stories has to do with listening. Most of us think of listening in a fairly literal fashion, human beings listening or not listening to one another, the pleasure of attending to a familiar piece of music. The word derives from the Old English, listenen, which means quite simply to pay attention. But listening can have a far broader and more capacious meaning, moving out beyond the small apparatus of the ears to the hands or belly or enveloping spirit mind. When a massage practitioner talks of listening to the body, or a gardener describes herself as listening to the land, when writers and artists explain that they are listening to their work in progress, they're using the word as I would like to use it here, as an extended metaphor for openness and receptivity, less actual than symbolic, less physical than metaphysical, rippling out from the self-centered human to the farthest reaches of the non-human world. I've been exploring such listening for a number of years, tracking it through literature and literary history, Buddhism, nature writing, science and sociology, comforted by the echoes and connections between those very different fields. I've also interviewed several dozen expert listeners, writers and therapists, naturalists and storytellers, along with a handful of superb musicians. Some of those I quote are famous and familiar: Montaigne, Chekhov and Virginia Woolf, Mary Oliver, Barry Lopez. Some are our own magnificent contemporaries: the botanist Robin Wall Kimmerer, the trumpeter Frank London, the avant-garde singer Meredith Monk. Others again are personal friends and colleagues, little known outside their own immediate circle. Their stories are included in the chapters that follow, along with memories and impressions of my own. In Praise of Listening is composed of 13 chapters, each one made up of a number of short sections or essayettes, which can themselves be heard in any order. It focuses at first on human-centered listening, listening to childhood, listening inwards, and gradually moves out into the surrounding world, listening to the wild, to the little sounds of every day. After a couple of chapters devoted to professional listening, listening to music, writers listening, it reaches a place where listening overlaps with what one might call the ear of the heart, communing with the dead, listening to silence or to the spirit, to arrive finally at a kind of global listening, all our relations, where there is nothing and no one that is not worth listening to. A world of racket and distraction, such generous, expansive listening is increasingly under siege. But it remains a skill worth honouring, worth passing on, a source of clarity and joy and wise embodiment, as well as a vital bridge to those with whom we disagree. Many an old story begins with the words, "Long ago, when animals could speak," writes naturalist Lyanda Lynn Haupt. Perhaps the corollary would be just as good an opening: "Long ago, when people could listen." Consider the following quotations. Everything in life is speaking, is audible, is communicating, in spite of its apparent silence. It is not just a tale that the saints spoke with trees and plants in the wilderness, or that masters talked with the sun, moon, and stars. Hazrat Inayat Khan. The more you listen, the more you will hear. W.B. Matthew. Chapter 1. Children Listening. Some linguists believe that the oldest word is hist, listen, Kathleen Dean Moore. The small sounds of the past. Long ago, back before adult time began, I remember lying on the rug beside the fire, with the grey rain pouring down outside, and my folk singer uncles on the record player, their heavy, grainy, grown-up voices, familiar and monotonous. Ye Helans and ye Lalans, a wha hae ye been? They slain the Earl of Murray and laid him on the green. Years later, as I neared the end of this book, those songs returned to me in dreams. The house was dark and hunched under a starry sky, everyone in it fast asleep. But my uncles were still singing those old folk songs, their voices blazing out into the night. Many of us turn to images to spark our memories, the childhood drawings still stuck to the belly of the old refrigerator, the family album crammed with faded photographs. But sounds, too, can be powerfully evocative. My friend Eleanor Adams was born in Connecticut in 1916 and spent her childhood summers on an island called Deer Isle. Deep into her 90s, she remembered the sound of every local truck, each with its characteristic engine. She liked to wake up early, in what for her was the middle of the night, to listen to the milkman in his horse-drawn wagon, the clatter of hoofs striking the metalled road, the clink of the glass bottles set down on the stoop. Children watch and listen, notice, pay attention. They lie on the worn rug in front of the fire and hear the click of a silver needle against the pocked top of the thimble, the soft intake of someone's breath. Nothing is too modest or humdrum to be enjoyed. Mariel Kinsey grew up in China, where her parents were missionaries. She remembered the tall stand of grasses behind the family compound, sort of like corn, she said, and how the children liked to play there, rustling through. She described, too, a neighbour called Mrs. Houska, who used to hand out slices of bread and butter sprinkled with sugar. Kinsey was 6 or 7 at the time, and still recalled how it felt to bite into one of those slices. White bread slathered with butter and sugar, and the crunching sound of the sugar. Isn't that something? In an increasingly noisy and intrusive world, such memories can act as catalysts, reminding us to attend to our own present-day impressions or listen inwards to what our bodies have to say. It's as if in summoning such long-lost sounds, we were able to reconstitute the ground underfoot and the sky overhead, the very foundations of our human being. Remember to love your sense of hearing, advises the composer W. A. Matthew. Love the echo of the world calling us awake inside our skulls. Little velvet voice. As a child, I was accused of being dreamy and distracted, of not listening when the grown-ups spoke to me. I was scolded, too, for making too much noise. Little velvet voice, my father used to croon, mock-soothingly. As I grew older, he would repeat the description of Cordelia in King Lear. Her voice was ever soft, gentle, and low, an excellent thing in woman. Ha! I would respond, noisily, emphatically, shutting the door hard and racing off upstairs. Papa might fancy himself in the role of Lear, but I had no interest in playing Cordelia. My voice was never going to be soft, gentle, and low. But listening was something else entirely. Listening had always been important. My own memories began in London, with the pigeons calling from the sill outside the window and the slap of warmish water in a yellow-painted bath. My mother says I loved being sung to and would coo and gurgle in appreciation. At 18 months, I was given a giant teddy bear, always known as Big Teddy, who grunted when you turned him upside down, a wonderfully robust and satisfying sound. I loved Big Teddy and thought him very funny and impressive. But best of all was when Mama read to me or told me stories. She was delicious like that, listening, my mother wrote, in the notes she kept at the time, and I wished I always had the patience to keep her so. The summer I turned 3, we moved to Wiltshire, to a square thatched house called Conebury, not far from Stonehenge. My mother pictures me dancing around the house, interviewing everyone and collecting all the stones, a shoe stone, a bottle stone, a letter stone, and bringing her information on the birds and flowers and spiders and life in general. But I liked silence too, and solitude and calm. I remember crouching in the linen cupboard among the soft heaped towels, listening to the slap of the iron in the nursery, the grown-up music floating from downstairs. Often I'd lie down flat under the piano, letting my whole body fill up with its thunder, watching Mama's long feet as they pressed the pedals. Or I'd race outside and hide in the tall grass, listening to the bantams squabbling in the henhouse, the harsh cry of the cockerel tearing open the sky. We lived close to each other in those days, physically close. We heard the intake of each other's breath, my father shaving, spitting out, the water running for a long, hot bath. If home is composed in part of such familiar sounds, then Conabri was made of Nanny's small transistor radio, always tuned to Radio 1, and the Beatles singing, "She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah." It was the glint and crackle of the nursery fire and our own obedient, fumbling, soft-voiced prayers. It was the board that creaked halfway down the passage under the thick felt of the McEwen tartan carpet as someone got up to tend a wailing baby. It was the shrill of Mama's morning kettle, the blackbird caroling outside my father's study window, the crunch of yellow gravel as my bike swerved to a stop. I sped like a minnow through that wide mesh of sound, hardly distinguishing human from non-human. Just as each bird had its own song, so each plant or animal or insect had its own distinctive sound. There was the cool squelch when you pulled a daffodil from between its long green leaves, the rough hee-haw of our donkey, Gypsy, cavorting in the nearby field, the impassioned thrum of a grasshopper in the curl of my closed hand. There were the tall, indolent swans sailing down the River Avon, ruffling their feathers, turning their ferocious beaks from side to side. Everything spoke to me and steadied me, showed me how to listen. Not being heard. It may well be that things are different now, but when I was a child, the grown-ups seemed to belong to another world entirely. They had their own culture and preoccupations, their own inscrutable jokes and anecdotes, their own way of drawing back and becoming utterly, unassailably silent. I remember trying to work out what they really meant, beyond the laughter and the kisses and the charged, emphatic welcome. Did Papa like that gruff man with a moustache? Was Mama actually interested in what the nice lady at the post office had to say? Or were they just pretending? It was hard to tell. I longed to translate those adult words and gestures back into my own vernacular, to get at what I thought of as the truth. We were still at Conabri when I began to ponder this, and there were four of us at home, ranging in age from 7 1/2 to barely 2. It was as if we were in some way interchangeable, a litter of soft-haired, bright-eyed little creatures lounging on the sofa or across the floor. Papa worked as a barrister in the city law courts, and we only ever saw him on weekends. Our mother, on the other hand, was almost always there. But there were groceries to order, letters to write, flowers to arrange and rearrange. There were calls to make, dinner parties to be planned. I think it was hard for her to see us as individuals, each with an equivalent centre of gravity, dark with unexpected angers, rifted with sudden bursts of exultation. Only very rarely did she take the time we craved to sit and listen. A rush of memories. In the course of gathering material for this book, I asked many people to describe their early memories of sound. My friend Meg Fisher wasn't sure at first that she had anything to tell. Most of her childhood memories were visual ones, but then she recalled the silver bell on her tricycle. "I can really distinctly remember the sound that metal bell made. Tring, tring! It made that nice, satisfying little tring every time you pressed it." Suddenly, she could see the twisted handle of the bell and feel her thumb on it, see the handlebar to which it was attached and the way that handlebar connected to the trike's front wheel, the white cement of the sidewalk, the rather rough, parched lawn. All those details were released by her clear memory of the bell. They had been locked away, inaccessible, until the sound freed them. Gradually she came up with a long catalogue of childhood sounds, from the squeak of her sneakers shinnying up a metal pole to the whump and hiss of her mother's steam iron and the flapping of fresh sheets on the line. She was too small to help, but she remembered her mother pinning up the sheets and the sun and shadows moving through them. And there was a sound, the sound of those big sheets in the wind. There is a strange delight in keeping track of such things, brightening and enlivening each passing day, while also reaching back deep into the past, where adults tend to focus almost exclusively on the human voice, whether internal or external, sung or spoken. Children make no distinction between what is and is not worth listening to. Everything talks, from the spit and crackle of a new-laid fire to the kiss and slurp of raindrops on a distant roof. In Great Expectations, Charles Dickens describes his hero, Pip, lying awake in bed, listening to those extraordinary voices with which silence teems. The closet whispered, the fireplace sighed, the little washing stand ticked, and one guitar string played occasionally in the chest of drawers. Acknowledging this is more than an act of pleasurable nostalgia. It also serves to ground us in the present, encouraging us to pause for a moment, stop and listen, and remind us of an openness and receptivity that are still possible, even now. There are sounds that energize and nourish us, that catch our ears and open up our hearts, sounds that return us to ourselves again. "It makes me so happy," someone said to a good friend of mine, "just to listen to you breathe." The Big House. When I was 8, we moved to Marchmont, an enormous sandstone palace in the Scottish borders. There were 4 of us children, then 5, then 6, looked after by a nanny and a nurserymaid on an upper floor, while our parents lived their separate lives on the floor below. If the grown-ups sat up late, talking over dinner, their voices did not reach us. If my little sister whimpered in her distant cot, I could not hear, did not get up to soothe her. My room was in the middle of the house, facing the front drive with its long avenue of beeches. On winter nights I lay in bed listening to the rasp of my own breath, the front door opening, closing, a last burst of adult laughter. I could hear the cars starting up outside, their lights set dazzling probes across my narrow ceiling. Marchmont was a metropolis in and of itself, housing a multitude of different voices. There were the squeals and protests of the younger children and the bright music from the nursery radio. There was the soft, rambling chatter of the cleaning ladies as they moved from room to room, rich Glaswegian, Border Scots, the flounce of sheets as they changed a bed, the roar of the vacuum cleaner. A door would swing sharply open and then sharply shut, and you'd hear the tread of feet in the downstairs hall and a stranger's voice hallooing up the stairs. Down on the ground floor, in the big old-fashioned kitchen, Mrs. Shearer would be peeling the potatoes, dropping them one by one into a bowl of fresh, cool water, while Mrs. Forsyth busied herself with soups and stews and scones and apple pies. One floor up, in what had been my grandmother's boudoir, my mother would be sitting at her desk, paying bills or writing letters, talking on the phone. At Christmas and Easter, and for most of the summer holidays, the house was crammed with visitors, aunts and uncles and cousins, family friends, visiting nannies, elderly priests. Passionate conversations would unfold in every room, as if each one were a stage set all its own. Gossip and stories in the kitchen and scullery, household management and the domestic arts, including children and their education, in my mother's sitting room, politics in the dining room, where the men sat late over their liqueurs. As a child, I could drift from room to room, eavesdropping casually en route, communing less with other humans than with the house itself. Each piece of furniture had a voice of its own, from the sagging wheeze of the library sofa to the shush of the drawing-room curtains, composed of narrow strips of ivory-coloured silk. On rainy days, I used to wander around for hours, rustling the dried rose petals in the front hall, listening to the faint strains of my mother's Mozart, or the tinkle of the chandelier as the washing machine whirred and juddered on the floor above. Hunched on the stairs, I could hear my world in its entirety, sighs and creaks and shouts and murmurs, laughter, birdsong, distant voices, divided into generous swathes by the great bell which rang at stately intervals throughout the day, and always the hum of the house itself, so large and so sweet-scented. Invisible. As a child at Conabry, I spent a lot of time alone, climbing trees or crouched in the long grass behind the hedge. I watched my mother as she snipped with her sharp secateurs among the flowers, peered through the small paned windows to see my father at his desk. At Marchmont, too, there was a game I played, shadowing some blinkered adult along the corridor and down the stairs. It demanded silence, caution, near invisibility, the willingness to pause a moment, to stand very still. Later I would move out into the garden, out into the surrounding countryside. I loved it then, in May and June especially, when the roses bloomed in sumptuous clusters at the edges of the lawn, and the blue tits rustled from the dark, close-woven hedge. It was as if each strand of sound possessed its own individual colour, blue and brown and green and silver-grey. There was nothing that did not speak, that could not be spoken, from the creak and swagger of the big old-fashioned wheelbarrow to the twist of water from the fountain, splashing sideways in the wind. Out beyond the garden was a narrow stream, known to us as the Swarden Burn. It ran clear and cool, the water glinting over the stones. Brown trout rested in the deep, slow-moving pools. You could see the frill of their gills turning with the current. I remember the seethe of green as I crouched up to my thighs in the water, reaching forward into the soft, arched hollow under the bank, listening, as if my hands themselves had ears. Sun warmed the grass, the leggy stalks of meadowsweet and nettles and rose campion. Under the bridge lurked the dark tire coil of an eel. I did not want to be seen while I was doing this. If I caught sight of another human being, one of the foresters or a keeper's boy, someone perched on a tractor far across the field, I would slip back into the shadows till they passed. The smallest thing was enough to make me freeze. A sudden flurry of pigeons from the little wood, the quick fillip of sound as a troutling leapt upstream. It was as if the wind blew through my hair into my empty skull, and the light thrilled in my wrist bones, as if the chirr of the grasshoppers whirred in my own chest. I was invisible. I was listening. I was catching fish with my hands. Left to our own devices. After she read the previous passages, my friend Pat Music sent me a cornucopia of beloved childhood sounds, from the soaring wind among the pines and the incessant fluttering of the aspen leaves to the squeak of snow underfoot and the shh of ice skates in a frigid Colorado winter. Another friend, Letitia Bermejo, recalled the wind in the poplars outside her grandfather's house in France. "It sounded like water," she said. "It sounded like gravel. It's amazing how many things it could sound like. The sound of the sea, the sound of thunder, the sound of rain pouring down, and slapping on the windows and slapping on the roof." Bermejo remembered human sounds as well, including the clink and rattle of the rag and bone man as he trundled through the streets in his old cart. He would shout, "What am I?" obviously some version of rag and bones. She had clear memories, too, of the man who sharpened knives. There was a very particular whistling sound. Tr-tr-roo, like one of those little pan pipes. It would go up, and then it would go down, and then it would go up, and you always knew, oh, there's the sharpener. Asking people to map or draw these sounds, or just to mimic them, elicited yet more surprising details. My mother recalled the hiss of the gas fire in her childhood nursery and the cry of the muffin man from the street below. Radio host Daisy Mathias spoke with nostalgic fondness of a particular cement pad near her parents' garage. And on the cement pad were three metal covers that closed off the garbage pails. That's where trash was put. And that little scree-click when you stepped on the pedal. We don't hear that anymore. I was struck both by the precision of these memories and by the satisfaction evoked by their retrieval. It was as if each of us were once a miniature John Cage or native elder, delicately receptive to the surrounding soundscape. But that way of knowing the world is being forgotten, displaced by the gadgets and distractions of the digital age. The first time I saw someone reach for her mobile in the happy hubbub of a family Thanksgiving, I was startled by her rudeness. Now I am sorrowfully unsurprised to witness a driver backing uphill into moving traffic, her cell still pinioned to her ear, or the student strolling across campus under a radiant moon, fixated on the small screen of her phone. People have always been distractible, writes techno-critic Nicholas Carr. Minds wander, attention drifts. But we have never carried on our person a tool that so insistently captivates our senses and divides our attention. All too soon, not listening to other people becomes not listening to the larger world, and ultimately, not even to ourselves. What is lost? In the summer of 2015, Oliver Sacks wrote a short essay called The Machine Stops, which later appeared in The New Yorker. Sacks was a writer and neurologist, best known for Awakenings and The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, as well as a lively and surprising memoir, On the Move. He was, above all, an enthusiast with a brilliant, original, astonishingly well-stocked mind. But what he saw as he left his apartment and moved out into the New York City streets had begun to trouble him. People peering into little boxes or holding them in front of their faces, walking blithely in the path of moving traffic, totally out of touch with their surroundings. Young parents staring at their cell phones and ignoring their own babies as they walk or wheel them along. At 21 years old, I travelled around the States on a Greyhound bus, enjoying many lively conversations along the way. On that same bus now, passengers barely raise their eyes from their tiny screens. The willingness to be open to a casual encounter, to trade impressions with a stranger, has almost completely disappeared. More subtle forms of listening are also under siege, from private wool gathering or rumination, to communing with the past or the beloved dead, to the many pleasures that reside in silence. The immediate present is undermined, perforated by a sense of elsewhere, writes Sven Burkitz in Changing the Subject, Art and Attention in the Internet Age. Always drawn toward the latest piece of news, the latest bleep, our attention is splintered, fragmented, broken up. In a recent interview, the poet Joy Harjo spoke of trying to protect her own creative focus. She was working at her desk when she heard a ding from her computer and realized she'd responded like one of Pavlov's dogs. It shocked her, she said. That's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to stay on my track of listening. It made her wonder why she was reacting in that way. But of course she knew the reason all too well. Somebody is hungry for money, so if they keep you there with these sounds, then they will have your attention. And your attention means money for them. In a world where the airwaves, all the airwaves, are increasingly choked with noise, that battle for our attention has now reached a crescendo. Sacks and Burkitz are not alone in trying to sound a warning. Over the last decade, the number of thoughtful escape manuals has continued to proliferate. Early classics included Nicholas Carr's The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, and William Powers' Hamlet's Blackberry, Building a Good Life in the Digital Age, followed more recently by Cal Newport's Digital Minimalism, Choosing a Focused Life in a Noisy World, Jenny O'Dell's How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy, Catherine Price's How to Break Up with Your Phone, The 30-Day Plan to Take Back Your Life, and Johan Hari's Stolen Focus, Why You Can't Pay Attention, and How to Think Deeply Again. Price states the issue with heartbreaking clarity. Our attention is the most valuable thing we have, she says. We experience only what we pay attention to. When we decide what to pay attention to in the moment, we're making a broader decision about how we want to spend our lives. The new noise. If the allure of shiny, pocket-sized devices is one reason for not listening, another is the ever-increasing noise. The poet Anne Carson describes a date with friends one steamy summer evening. The two couples meet in the street and decide to try a nearby restaurant. The place is dark, cool, oaken. It is also unbearably loud. But none of
Sample complete. Ready to continue?